Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
And it never got removed. And it should.
Oh, shit.
You can just press circle on the circle on the main menu and just pick whichever level you want to go to.
Welcome to Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast. Your place for resources and in-depth conversations with other game development professionals. I'm your host, John J.P. Podlasic. I've worked at 10 different game companies, starting back in 1989 with the TurboGrafx-16. Over the decades, I've developed games like Mortal Kombat, Avengers Initiative, Beavis and Butthead, and numerous others. I now work for a startup called Level X. But this podcast isn't about me. It's about you and the game development community. So if you have questions or ideas, give a call, 224-484-7733, or go to the gamedevadvice.com website. I have a great episode for you today, so let's kick things off with the new Game Dev Advice. Today's guest is Dave Grace, who has been in the industry since 1996, programming on the original PlayStation, and has worked on just about every console since as well, including PC and Oculus platforms. He's lived in Chicago, San Francisco, Tokyo, and now in Canada, and worked for Viacom, Activision, Square Enix, and his own studio of 12 years. All right, let's kick things off with Dave Grace. Okay, I've got Dave Grace here joining me today. Hey, Dave, how you doing?
Oh, good.
Cool. So let's start off. What's your current role?
Right. Well, I'm the CTO at Kitazaru, which is a Canadian subsidiary of Sandor Games, which is a company I founded with a bunch of other guys back in 2007.
Wow. Okay. So you're going on 12 years. That's great.
Yeah, it's been going pretty good.
Okay.
We're up to about, I think, 110 people. There's about 100 in Foster City, California, and then we've got 9 out here in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada.
Okay. So those two locations, that makes sense. That's good to have a foothold in Foster City there. All right. So how did you get started in this video game industry? If you kind of talk me through it.
Sure. I think you were there actually. when I got out of school, I did audio engineering in Miami and I got a job doing pager hardware design back when pagers were a thing. And so I was down in Florida for a while and somehow one of the email lists, I think one of the alumni lists from school came across with this job offer for an audio gig in Chicago at a small game studio called Viacom New Media. And they're looking for people to do audio system design and like a cross-platform library doing sound stuff. And I was pretty up on that and I flew out and did an interview and I guess I was good enough. And yeah, got hired and I went to Chicago.
Right. And I'm trying to remember back, like we had a pretty good size audio department. There was like Michael Henry and Rob Herman and Martin Wild. I mean, it was, how big was that department when it at its peak?
Yeah, I think that was the four people that you listed plus me. Yeah. And so there was two guys doing software and then two guys doing sound design. But yeah, that was a good, good place to grow and work. And I learned a lot of stuff from the engineers there, particularly like Todd Squires, who is a badass.
He is a wicked smart badass. Yeah. I haven't seen him in about a year. He doesn't live too far from here, but yeah, he's amazing.
I'm still using his editor.
Was it an E3? Was it E3 or something?
E93, yeah.
E93, right. Oh, yeah.
Fits on a floppy.
Right. Fits on, yeah. I used that at 3Com a little bit when we were trying to edit some stuff. All right. So can you kind of dive more into the audio programming you were doing? Because it was software.
So I was a musician growing up and everything. So I knew my way around MIDI. which is the spec you use for keyboard control of everything. So knowing that, and basically we wanted to write a sort of a wavetable synthesis player to do music playback, and then on PlayStation and PC, so you could play back like sequence music, like what you'd now think of as a what do you call those things, like Rex files basically, or that kind of stuff. You want to be able to trigger samples and pitch shift them appropriately to do musical notes. So we got all that working, and then I think I was there for about a year and a half, 96 97. And somehow I heard of an opportunity out in California doing basically the same kind of thing, and California is much warmer, and I said, let's go try that.
Right.
And yeah, so that was my first job in the Bay Area and in San Mateo, and that was a small company called Z-Axis, which was an independent studio. Mm-hmm. And I stuck around there for quite a long time.
They did the BMX. Was it Dave Mira? Or
yeah, that was my game. I was the lead on that.
Oh, wow.
So I did audio for a little while, like 2-3 years, and I had basically wrote the same kind of engine, but doing it on PlayStation 1, N64, Dreamcast, PC, and then later on PS2, Xbox. It pretty much supported all that stuff. And at some point, it was all working, and they're like, hey, we need someone to do some game stuff and physics. And turned out I'm actually not too bad at that. And so I did physics on the Thrasher Skate and Destroy game, which was actually Rockstar's very first title.
Wow.
Bit of trivia. And then after that, BMX, we went to do this prototype for a BMX thing, and that ended up being Dave Mira Freestyle BMX, and that sold really well. And then BMX 2, and then the ill-fated BMX 3. And then right about then, Activision bought the studio. And so I worked for Activision for a few more years. And then after a while, six other guys and me decided, you know what? We could have our own company and do this. And so we split off and formed our studio, and we're still here.
Wow. No, that's great that you guys had the idea and you've actually been going for 12 years.
Yeah, there was one break in the middle. We kind of had to downsize a lot. And at the time, I had moved out to Tokyo and was working from there. And so I had to get a job, and I worked for Square Enix for 6 months on what became Final Fantasy 15.
Huh. No, that's cool. I'm sure that was an interesting experience.
Yeah.
Where?
Yeah, it was interesting.
Yeah, it was on Final Fantasy. Yeah, you hear the stories and all those kind of things. So I'm sure that was...
I mean, I went out there having not worked for a really, you know, giant developer with a huge track record before, and thinking, okay, I'm going to learn some serious stuff from these guys because they must be amazing, right? And it turns out they just throw a ton of people at it. And it's they don't do anything any smarter than anybody else. They just pay people less and throw more people on. And it was a slog.
Yeah. That's some of the things I've heard too, is like, you know, you're like, oh man, they must have it really refined and figured out. And it's just like, you know, they get halfway down, they're like, holy crap, now what are we going to do? And then they just like reboot, and you know, they had more than their share of problems. It's not this refined.
Yeah.
Science that you would think. What about advice that you would give someone that's, say, looking to get their first job in the industry?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you know, we started so long ago, it's a bit of a double standard, because like, if somebody had come to me knowing as little as I knew when I was starting in 20 years ago, they're pretty much not going to get too lucky. On the flip side of that, there's a lot of tools you can just download and use now. So basically, there's no excuse for you not getting Unity or Unreal and building something and having a prototype up and running that you can show off. So I think my advice would be, you know, if you're trying to apply for a job somewhere, the best thing you can do is build a playable demo and send it out. You know, here's a link to it, post it online. It's basically all free to do this stuff and show that you can do something pretty cool and interesting. You know, take some initiative and build something on your own. And I would say that some of the things that are really in high demand all the time are people that have really strong shader kung fu and VFX artists. We are always short of VFX artists. So those guys, pretty much if you're an expert on one of those things, you can write your own ticket.
I think tech artists too, right? Somebody that can...
riggers and tech artists tend to fit in anytime.
Yeah. Well, especially too, like a tech artist that can improve pipelines and write code and do stuff that blends into, like, say, doing shader work and those kind of things, pipelines. Those are always in demand.
Yeah, Python jockeys.
Yeah. I was going to ask about just kind of like, what advice would you give an engineer or an aspiring CTO? Just, you know, somebody that's already in the engineering track and, you know, say halfway through their career or, I don't know, 5-10 years into it, like what kind of advice would you give on the engineering side?
Machine learning is like sort of the hot ticket thing, but I honestly don't have a really good application for it in games to point you out yet. But it's one of those things where if you can put it on your resume and become a master of it, it's going to get some attention and people will be excited about it. It's good to know more than just one little niche of things. You should be able to understand the architecture of a full game from start to finish. You know, what are the trade-offs when doing animation in one style or versus like doing things procedurally, what different kinds of UI systems, and then, you know, all the way to per platform stuff. Like what are the advantages of, you know, how fast is a PS4 GPU versus Xbox One, that kind of stuff. So good to be well-rounded, good to keep up on latest technology as in any job, really. You just don't want to be obsolete or useless.
What other kind of advice would you give somebody trying to get in the industry or who's, say, working in the industry?
Yeah, I think one strong piece of advice would be don't burn bridges because it's actually not as big an industry as you think. And some there is some level of connection from everybody to everybody else. So yeah, if you do need to leave a studio, if they do downsize, don't leave on bad terms because there's a really strong chance you're going to be calling up those people or they're going to be calling up you later on to try to find another job. So if you can always maintain good relationships with people, that's a really important thing.
Yeah, no, I would agree. It, I think people look at like, oh, it's a huge, it's giant industry. It's like the movie industry and it's huge. I don't know in the movie industry, so I can do whatever I want here because no one's going to know. And it's like, man, this industry is so small and it's like, you know, 1 or 2 degrees of Kevin Bacon, you know, but everyone's connected somehow. And yeah, if you go around doing crazy shit or burning bridges or it will then later come back to haunt you. And
absolutely. I could think of a couple of cases that I probably shouldn't talk about. So
I could think of cases too, where there's people and you just, sometimes you see the resume. It's like year and a half. You're like, no one's called their bluff on this yet. It was like, how do they staying employed when they go around doing crazy crap like this? And it's like it's going to run out at some point because they're going to burn all their options out and their name is dirt from crap they've done. And then they're going to be shocked.
And on the flip side though, if you do a really good job and you work at some place even for a short time, but you know, if you have a good reputation, like this guy was awesome, you know, I would love to work with him again, that's going to pay off down the road. So yeah, just always, you know, treat people the way you want to be treated and show your best stuff all the time.
Yeah, I would agree with that also. Because yeah, there've been people I worked with that, you know, were in entry-level roles, but you know, they worked hard and they had a good attitude and they got stuff done. And then, you know, a year or two later, it'd be like, we're looking for somebody. And I'm like, hey, you know, and it was Jonathan Guy. He's up at Ravensoft. I'll ping him and see what he's doing because, you know, he went, you know, above and beyond what was asked and figured out how to do things and did great work and had a good attitude. And then, it works both ways and people will look for, you know, opportunities to help people who do good work.
I think a lot of testers have worked their way into production that way. They've been, you know, a really outstanding detail oriented tester and somebody later on is like, yeah, we need an associate producer for something. And then that's the person they're going to call.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's changed in some ways versus what it used to be, because back in the day, it was kind of like QA was almost like boot camp, right? It was almost like, can you survive the gauntlet of, you know, these crazy hours playing buggy games for crappy pay and still keep your shit together and do good work. And that's how it used to be. And now there are schools that are like focusing on, you know, game production and people are coming out and like out of the box, you know, straight from school, being great at production and having learned about different methodologies and working on teams. Just from my experience, I'm thinking of like Full Sail. There's been some great people like the masters of game production, I think was the title. And out in Utah, University of Utah has like a master's game production track that we've talked to some pretty bright people from there.
Cool.
But it's a tough job too. And I don't think people, because I did it for 4 or 5 years and I don't think people appreciate it from a distance, but the really good ones are appreciated, especially by the engineers, you know, because they find those bugs and they'll sit in that dev system and they'll figure out how to replicate it so that the engineer can fix it, you know. And good QA people are definitely useful.
Yeah, I think attention to detail is sort of the overarching theme. You know, whether you're an artist or programmer or tester or anything, like if you're the person that stands out as being really, you know, you really care about the details and you really care about the quality of what you're producing, it's going to show, and that's going to open doors for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree, because right, artists that can, you know, follow all the instructions and they give assets that are, you know, right poly count and textures and aren't a mess that people are like, oh, we got to fix all this and go find that person. They got to fix it, you know. So it is about, you know, it's craftsmanship really in some ways.
Yeah, totally.
It's about your craft and being focused on that and not being like, oh, I don't want to be doing this. I want to be doing something else. But just, you know, this is your craft. You're learning it. You're improving it. And, you know, having that sense of ownership and pride when you do the work that it'll pay off. Okay. What's been like your favorite or top two games or projects that you've worked on?
Yeah, top one is probably Dave Mirra BMX. That was pretty much my baby. I spent like a year of working 7 days a week. But it was because like, it was basically me doing the entire game code. And then we had an engine guy and another guy just doing front end, but I got to own the whole thing. And so I wanted to show I could make this thing that was really good. So I just dove into it and it came out at exactly the right time when BMX bikes were getting really popular and we had a great license and the publisher was really good and it sold super well. So I would say that's about as good as it ever gets.
Yeah. That was a big deal in its time. How many millions was it?
It was somewhere 2.7 to 3, depending, I think, for BMX 1.
Yeah.
And BMX 2 was somewhere around 1. But yeah, it did really well. And then basically kept Acclaim from going out of business for at least a couple of years.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. It was Acclaim. I forgot. Yeah. I was trying to remember. Yeah. The guys from New York. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, they were characters. the other one I would say is Sly Collection, where we did a port of the PS2 Sly Cooper 1, 2, 3 games and ported to PS3. Hmm. And then later on, we ported to Vita. Those ones were done by Sucker Punch. Those guys are absolute badasses from a programming standpoint, like head and shoulders above any other code base I've ever worked on. So that was cool to work on because you got to actually see this code. And that's been the one time I've, you know, read through some stuff and been like, wow, these guys are really much better than me. So it gives you something to work towards. But they're still doing amazing stuff. And I'm sure it's because they've still got the same guys. Like Chris Zimmerman there is just amazing.
No, and just to be honest, when I hear engineers say like, wow, that's really good code, that's a huge compliment, you know, because 90% of the time engineers are like, oh, this code's all crap. I'm just going to rewrite
90%
it.
90% of the
time it is. Yeah. And I know I'm always like, oh, you're killing me, man. You got to rewrite all the code. What's it going to do to our deadline? But that's the answer I usually hear. So the fact that you were impressed with their code is that says volumes.
Yeah, right? I mean, at three games, I think, you know, of all three, I only fixed one honest to goodness bug, something that shipped on the originals.
Wow.
And the rest of it was all just porting and everything just worked. It was amazingly well done.
Yeah, I mean, because normally those porting gigs are just train wrecks, right? You're inheriting this giant sloppy mess and there's no documentation and the people are gone if you need to reach out to them to ask how something works. So
yeah.
That must have been amazing.
Yeah, that one worked really well. And Metacritic came out. It was like 83, I think, for the port. It helped that the original games were really good, but it was super solid. Everything was like came out on time, on budget, and just really proud of that one.
Yeah. Who published that one again?
Sony Internal.
Yeah. Sony Internal. Yeah, yeah. Right, right. So what are you curious about right now, just in the industry?
I would say I'm curious about machine learning, but not quite enough to suck it up and learn it. I've been playing around a lot with like Node.js and doing server client stuff, doing like real-time stats and things for games, which is kind of fun. A lot of the other stuff I'm playing with is more just work-related. I've been doing custom animation nodes in Unreal and just general game code in there, but that's just more paying the bills. But I would say machine learning is one of those things that's out there, and I'm trying to figure out a good excuse to learn it and get around to it, but I just haven't quite got there yet.
Yeah. Can you talk about what you're working on now or what you published previously? Or
Sure. Well, I mean, last year we partnered with Toys for Bob on the Spyro Remastered trilogy. So Toys for Bob was doing games 1 and 2. And we took over Spyro 3. I honestly underestimated just how much stuff was in that game. And so it, like you said, it does become a train wreck, especially because this one wasn't a straight port. We didn't have any code. We had to rebuild everything from scratch. That was a significant amount of work as we got towards October and had to ship for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
And then my company's been working with Oculus a bunch the past couple of years. We did a Marvel tie-in four-player co-op game in VR on the Rift called Marvel VR Powers United or something. And now we're doing a hack and slash like wizards and swords and sorcery kind of thing called Asgard's Wrath, which will be coming out this year. And so that's been keeping everybody busy for a little while.
Cool. Yeah, and that kind of bleeds into my next question, kind of like, what are your thoughts about AR and VR?
Yeah, honestly, I haven't played with AR much. Most of what we've been doing stuff on the Rift and on the, you know, the next platform that's going to be coming out. Mm-hmm. And VR is cool, especially once you add the touch controllers in. Once you have your hands out in front of you, you really become much more immersed in everything. Mm-hmm. I would say the price point is still pretty steep because you have to have a pretty big honking PC to run it.
And
so it's not quite mass market enough, but I'm convinced that will get fixed sooner or later. So yeah, it's a neat platform. It's sort of annoying to develop on because you're constantly taking this thing up and off your head. And so you're like, you want to hit a breakpoint, right? And the whole screen freezes and you have to pop the Rift like up onto the top of your head and like debug it. And then you like hit run and go back in. And so it's physically, it's a pain to develop on. Huh. But it's kind of it's a cool tech to goof around with.
Yeah. Well, and of course the new tech is the Quest coming out and stuff, which I keep talking about in this show. Just, it seems really interesting to me just in the sense that the price point, the accessibility, the not being so tethered, and it's not going to have the graphic fidelity, but you don't need a $4,000 computer with a giant video card and cables all over your place and cameras and all that crap too. So
yep.
I'm very excited to see what happens with the Quest.
Yeah, it's been, I've actually got one on my desk. It's a step down from Rift, but it's not too bad. You just really have to control the draw calls. You kind of have to optimize different stuff for it, but it's, it's going to be cool.
Yeah, no, it's getting more mass marketing. It's getting more accessible, that kind of stuff. So what about potential threats do you see to the game industry along with opportunities?
Threats, like obviously everything changed right around 2007. Like before that, you know, before iPhone, we could make a good living selling $40 games on consoles, and all of a sudden those games disappeared and they'd be, you know, 99 cents. Mm-hmm. So having more of that race to the bottom kind of stuff is not going to be good for the industry. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, having a billion devices out there where people can play your game is, you know, good if you can compete in the marketplace. So that's plus and minus. If I was an animator, I'd be worried about what people are doing with machine learning to generate realistic motion. That would scare me. I don't see a big threat to programmers on that side yet, but I do see a lot of like outsourcing companies that are like, yeah, we're going to partner with you and we'll do outsource code. And of course, what they want to do is just then, you know, the next job, they'll just do the job by themselves, right? And so
yeah,
if we're going to compete against people in Bangalore, that's we're not going to win economically. So that's a bit of a threat. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, the stuff that really scares me is I don't really know too many people from this industry who are actually, you know, retired. so that's not a...
Yeah.
You know, pretty much everybody leaves the industry or they go to teaching, or, you know, if they're lucky, they have a company that gets bought out by somebody and then they just cash in. Mm-hmm. I'm opting for number three if possible, but there's not a clear path to like financial security here.
No, you're right. And I think the stat I'd heard was 7 years is the average tenure in the industry, I think. And I'm not sure how accurate that is currently, but I'd heard that somewhere before. And yeah, you're right. There is a lot of just instability and companies coming and going. And since it's, you know, hits driven, you have a few duds and then they close down. Or even if you make money, they want to make more money. So they still close a bunch of studios and lay people off like Activision recently did. So there is definitely, it's not for the weak hearted to be in this industry.
Yeah, I'm not actually sure what the solution is. And, you know, the movie industry has a union system, right?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that ship is too late to sail in games, because you would have to then actually enforce it by not having people be able to hire non-union talent, or, you know, having mixed workforce. So it's a really tricky one.
Yeah. And there seems to be a big surge talking about the union thing. Having been on the side where I've seen, especially like the big media companies, they have a policy that says, you know, no union. So they find ways to work around that. And there's, especially in areas like in audio, you know, for voice talent, they have signatures, which are kind of, you know, the middleman, as they say, so that you can hire union talent at a no union publisher to skirt around it that way. So, you know, they have the best intentions with the union stuff, but then because of some of the restrictions it puts and some of the companies that just have that policy of no union, and then they find ways to skirt around it. And then, yeah, it's a complicated issue, and it's something I'm curious about. I'm interested to see where it goes, but it's not just, oh, we'll just get unions, that's going to fix everything, and that's going to make sure that people don't get laid off, because I think that's a naive approach. It's how does it make work conditions better? So in the event there is a layoff, that people are taken care of, and maybe they're taken better care of while they're there. But yeah, it's a very deep, tricky question.
Yeah, I'm sort of curious how that works in Hollywood with all the outsourcing VFX studios, like, because those aren't union based, right? And it's certainly not the ones that are not in the U.S. They haven't been telling great stories about how they're treated either. So maybe that's a bad comparison.
Yeah, no, I just know there's like, was it WETA or WETA, and those companies where they, it's very much, you know, you're a hired gun, right? You go in, you have a 6, 9, 12 month stint. You're paid hourly, you get time and a half. So, you know, you're not, you know, working for free, but it's not a lot of stability also, right? You kind of go from gig to gig that way. And I think your money goes in towards your union dues and things like that. But it's, I don't know a lot about it either. I just know there are those other areas where they have it. And we'll see if there's crossover or bleed into the game industry to take best practices from there. Not sure though. Okay. So what about a funny or odd story from working in the industry?
Good one. We did a Space Invaders reboot. This is, must've been back in, like 2099, something like that. It was on PlayStation 1. And somehow I just did audio code on it, but somehow this thing got all the way through Sony testing with the circle button. You just press the circle button on the main menu and it takes you to a level select. It was supposed to be a debug menu that was compiled out on the shipping build and it never got removed, and it shipped.
Oh shit.
You could just press circle on the circle on the main menu and just pick whichever level you want to go to.
Just like skip right ahead. Yeah, you're like, wait, exactly, a minute. Yeah.
It's like they left the debug menu in.
Wow.
We had one on Sly Collection. I was like getting way to the end. We're trying to ship the final Gold Master. And there was something where a TRC was coming back from Sony saying, I was using the wrong version of this library that got linked in. And I didn't have a newer version. And even if I had, it wouldn't have linked with some of the other stuff we were using.
Mm-hmm.
So the solution I had was to just open up the library file in a hex editor and find where it actually had the version number in ASCII and just change it. And it worked.
Yep, you're on 15.163. Now you're up to code.
Yep, exactly.
There you go.
It passed.
Yeah, it's so interesting on the console side because, what was it? TCRs and TRCs, like Sony was one and Microsoft was the other, because, you know, we can't agree on that. We have to call them, you're calling it that? Well, we're going to call it this, you know, technical requirements checklist. And
yeah, it's a big book.
Yeah, yeah. There were people that at Midway that, they specialized in that. And that was their niche in QA, was to be the keepers of those books and know those things inside and out. You know, all the tricks of pulling a controller when you're booting the disk and, you know, it has to recover. Man, it just,
yeah.
There's some nightmares around that
play
stuff.
In German to see all the text overlap, all the boxes.
Yeah, right. Because
it's always German.
It's always German. Yeah, because it's always like 30% longer and it goes over the boxes and you're like, oh man, you know, it's like, or there's content, you know, that you you can't have in Europe. So then you're doing different versions just because of this one thing here or there. It can't be in the German version. And it's tricky.
Okay, quick question break. What are your thoughts so far? Do you have a topic idea, a question to ask, or a guest suggestion? Let me know at 224-484-7733 or on the gamedevadvice.com website.
What kind of platforms are you guys developing for right now, if you can say?
We're just doing PS4, Xbox One, and Oculus and PC.
Okay.
Actually, the Switch is the one I have not worked on yet. Of all the platforms going back to like PlayStation 1, I think I've worked on pretty much everything except the Switch.
Hmm. Yeah, which has been a big hit for Nintendo, and it's cool.
Yeah.
Although Nintendo's always kind of tricky sometimes too, because at least before they weren't too concerned about third party and things like that. It was just kind of like, yeah, we make our money with our games and, you know, do our own thing.
But, yeah, it's really uncommon for a third party publisher to make money on Nintendo.
Yeah.
It's pretty much first party makes tons and then it just drops right off.
Mm-hmm. Yep, for sure.
But they do a fantastic job. I'm super impressed by Zelda.
Yeah.
Breath of the Wild.
Yeah, they get the quality part down. They have their loyal fans. And it seems like every other hardware release, they hit it out of the park. And the other ones, they tank, you know, whether it's Virtual Boy or then a Wii or a Wii U and now Switch. It's always, I'm sure I'm going to get some Nintendo fans like flaming me. But it's like sometimes I give them credit. They take shots, you know, it's not just about graphics and putting bigger chips in there and all that kind of stuff. You want to talk a little bit about living in Japan? That's a pretty interesting story.
Yeah. We moved out in 2011, like right after the big earthquake. We'd been planning to do it a year before. My wife's from Japan, so we were moving out so the kids could be with their grandparents and just because it was really cool.
Yeah.
Moved to Tokyo and I just telecommuted from there. And in 2013, I worked for Square Enix for 6 months and then till the company ramped back up and then I jumped back on. It was really cool. I love the place. It's an amazing country and a great place to be. And we would have probably stayed if we could afford to put the kids in international school there.
Very expensive out there. Yeah. In Tokyo, right?
But yeah, Tokyo can be pricey. So yeah. We came to Canada.
How did Canada equate into that? Was there a family connection or just?
No, not really. It's not actually too far from where I grew up in New York, but it's our CEO is from Ottawa and Ontario has a nice new tax break for game developers. If you want to open an office here, there's a
30%, 35%.
Yeah, it's like 30, yes, north of 30% basically kickback.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's really cheap to hire people here and kids can go to school in English and.
And that's all of Canada, that tax break, right? Because that's why
it's Ontario.
Okay.
And it only applies to Ontario residents. So Ottawa is kind of strange. We're right on the border with Quebec.
Right.
So it only applies to half our staff because the ones that live on the half south of the river.
I thought Montreal had kickbacks too because, you know, Ubi's got 5,000 employees up there and stuff.
Yeah, they totally do. And I think they had theirs first, but it depends on where the, you know, where the business is headquartered, right? So we're an Ontario business and so ours applies to Ontario.
I see. Yeah, no, that's that explains why there's just such a big gaming community in Canada because of those tax credits and things like that. And no, that's cool.
Yeah, it's a good place. I'm curious why the US doesn't do more of that, but I guess they don't feel they have to.
You know, there's been regional areas like there was a few years back, there was a big push down in Louisiana, of all places. Baton Rouge was rolling out the red carpet and attracting game companies down there. And they were doing tax credit kickbacks and things. And some studios set up shop down there. I know there's a huge EA testing facility and things in Baton Rouge because one of our...
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. It's like right on the campus too of one of the schools down there. They have some of the buildings and stuff, but yeah, Baton Rouge, because you know, that's another place you're just kind of like, no offense to Baton Rouge people, but it just seems like really hot and muggy and stuff in the summers just would be kind of brutal, but they were able to, you know, attract some game companies down there. I've heard of a few going down there. It makes sense. It attracts tech and good jobs and things like that. So you think states would kind of want to initiate that more, but we'll see.
Yeah, I think there was one proposal for New York last year that didn't end up approving in the legislature. So it didn't get there.
Mm-hmm. What about anything I should have asked you, but didn't? You're like, damn it, John, we should have talked about X.
Yeah, I was going to say, I haven't heard people on your podcast talk about which games have really impressed them or what's their favorite game they're playing lately and you know, why.
Yeah, that's a good question. I have not been staying up to date on things, to be honest. My Xbox Ones are in my son's room, so I'm woefully behind on the console side. But yeah, what about you? Is there anything you're playing lately? Or
My kids have been playing through Zelda, Breath of the Wild, and that's been really cool.
Mm-hmm.
The climbing mechanics are really nice. I'm sort of an animation nerd, so I've been really getting into how they're doing IK in the hands and beat to like keep them on the walls. I think it looks at least as good as Uncharted, which has probably set the bar for that.
Yeah.
So that's been fun to watch. I think all time most impressive game, I still go with Metal Gear Solid 1, because that for the machine and for the hardware and what they did was just mind blowing.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a period, you know, on the PlayStation with Gran Turismo and just trying to get the, you know, gold trophies and unlocking cars. And I spent a lot of time with that. I haven't found a game to stick like that. Although I do like the Forza driving games, and my sons and I used to play those when they were smaller. And it's almost kind of like overload too, because there's so many games out there, you know, between the consoles and mobile and stuff like that, that it's hard to find something that sticks. I've thought about getting a Switch because that would be a good device. It's a good form factor, and it I think it would be something fun to play with.
Yeah, my kids are a little younger, so I thought it was a no-brainer for them.
Yeah. Yeah, because they're 6, 10, 12, something like that? Or
10 and 12, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, those are perfect ages. Yeah. Cool. So where can people find you online? Website, Twitter, things like that?
Probably best bet is just Sanzaro. Sanzaro.com. That's got all our latest projects and our pages for job listings and everything, because we are always looking for talented people.
Right. And are most of the jobs in Foster City or Ottawa too?
Ottawa too, but yeah, Foster City and basically we're always looking for people that have strong kung fu.
Yeah, as we are also at Level X. Yeah, there's always a need for great talent, and yeah, I have many roles I'm trying to fill, and we keep filling roles, and there's still more to be filled. So yeah, it's people who have talent are in demand. So it's good for you if you're in those shoes. All right, well, great. Thanks, Dave, for being on this episode, and we'll be in touch.
Awesome. Thanks, John. It's been really good to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Game Dev Advice, the Game Developers Podcast. If you found it interesting or helpful, please leave a 5-star review. I'd really appreciate it. And don't forget to subscribe. I have a lot of great episodes coming out. As always, I want to hear from you, the game development community. So give me a call at 224-484-7733 or reach out on the website, gamedevadvice.com. I want to know your struggles, your questions, and your ideas. Since the podcast is really about you, the fellow game developer, and our game development community. Thanks and take care. Hey, just a quick note. I'm going to be at GDC next week, so look me up, and you can find me over at the Level X booth, S248. See you at GDC, maybe.